So, thank you all for coming. So tonight, I would like to talk about the 10 plagues, what their purpose was, what their impact was. That will be this week. There was actually a typo on the sign I sent out. I wrote destruction of creation. I meant to say destruction or creation. But either way, I think it's appropriate because, as we'll see, both are true. Okay, we're going to try to figure out if it's destruction or creation, or both. Which is probably what you would have gathered as soon as I said that, as well as destruction of creation. We'll try to talk about that. So let's just start with like a very brief overarching examination of the 10 plagues. We have 10 plagues. They're an integral major part of Pesach, certainly of the Seder. I think in most places where there are children, even if there are not, the 10 plagues are a big part of the process of the Seder. And different people will come up with different approaches based on various midrashim and statements of Chazal that Hashem brought the 10 plagues as measure for measure, mida keneged mida. And I think, Ms. Litzman, you mentioned that there are Haggadahs that have the entire listing of all the measure for measure. There are others that, other midrashim that say that Hashem approached the 10 plagues like a general going to war. Each of the 10 plagues follows the steps of the process of a war. And then you find in different places, different indications of what the purpose of the plagues were. Going all the way back to the Bris Ben Absarim, to the covenant, where Hashem told Avram that the Jewish people would be slaves in the land of Egypt, in a foreign land. And Hashem promises Avram that after the slavery, that the nation whom they will serve, I will judge. Which is an indication of plagues of some sort. Which would seem to indicate that it's a punishment for the Egyptians. Yet, you don't really find through the course of the plagues, if you go through the verses, that it's a punishment as much as Hashem pounding, bang power on the head, pounding the point home. I am in charge. I am Hashem. You are not in charge. I am in charge. So then the 10 plagues seem to be a process of Hashem proving himself, as it were, to Paro. So then it's not a punishment, it's Hashem proving himself. There are yet other sources that would seem to indicate again, if you go through the verses, this would seem to be, at least up to a point, that the purpose is to get the Jewish people out of slavery. Hashem will twist Paro's arm and twist it harder and harder and harder. Eventually, Hashem hardens Paro's heart. According to many sources, Paro still had some degree of free choice, of free will to let the Jewish people go, according to a number of sources. And he'll just twist Paro's arm until he finally says, cries uncle, and he lets the Jewish people go. So that would seem to indicate that it's a means of freeing the Jewish people from slavery. So what is it? What are these 10 plagues? What is their purpose? Generally in Torah, we don't like to have one thing serving as many different things, unless there's a connection. Because everything, ultimately, God is one, Torah is a oneness to it, and we always try to see where's the connection between all these different elements and all these different things. And so I think it would behoove us, moving towards Pesach, such an integral part of Pesach and the Seder, to figure out what is the theme, what is going on with these 10 plagues, and why are they important. So let us start. I'm going to disappoint you. We're not going back to Adam Harishon tonight. Okay? I know someone told me, you told me the Rabbi Halperin went back to Adam Harishon when he spoke before Purim. We're going to go back even further. For Adam Harishon. Oh, not bad, huh? Okay. We have to go back. We have to go back even further. Someone needs a pen? We have to go back even further than Adam Harishon. Okay.
And when you were saying about God hardening Pharaoh's heart,
uh-huh,
and that he had free will, he was feeling that. Was that after his son was...
That was earlier. That was already earlier in the process of the plagues. I think by the sixth plague or the seventh plague, they're already. Hashem says, God says, I am hardening Paro's heart. Up to a point, you see that it says that Paro hardened his own heart, and then at a certain point, God, it says that God hardened his heart, or his heart was hardened. Okay, so there's a certain point where Paro's heart is hardened already, but there are varying opinions as to whether or not it was fully hardened or just. Made it harder to choose. So we have to go back to the very beginning of creation over here to really get a picture of what's happening over here. Okay, God creates the world. The Talmud says, the Gemara says, that Hashem created the world with Asara Ma'amaros, with 10 utterances. 10 utterances. There are 10 times you will find in this section of the Torah, the very first section of the Torah dealing with the creation of the world, that it says, Hashem said, Vayomer, and he said, 10 times. The Gemara says, it's only 9, actually, if you count them, go through, it's only 9. And the Gemara says, the Talmud says, Bereishis, in the beginning, is the very first of the 10. That is the very first of the 10. The Vilna Gaon says that Bereishis, in the beginning, is the creation of time. Okay, time expired on that question. So, but it's the creation of time. In the beginning is the beginning of time, and everything else after that are the 10 utterances. Why are there? What does it mean when we talk about Asar Mamaris? 10 statements, 10 utterances that create the world. There are many angles and a lot to talk about. But for our purposes, what it means is that Hashem created a world. The world in Hebrew is called Olam. Olam comes from the word Helam. It hides. It hides Hashem's presence. And each of these statements is another layer of creation that brings the world, as it were, more and more hiddenness of Hashem's presence in the world. Okay, more and more hiddenness. Every statement. And then after 10, that is where it stops. We have 10 layers of hiding Hashem's presence in the world through these 10 utterances. And these 10 utterances create the natural world in which we live. Let there be light, let there be land, let there be trees, and let there be animals, and so on and so forth. And each of these is another layer of a natural world that is going to hide Hashem's presence in the world. And that's what we have, the natural world. And the task that we are tasked with is to perceive Hashem's presence in that world. But ultimately, it's a natural world. We have a natural world. The other, well, before the other, so you had a world, Adam appears on the scene, Adam sins, he eats from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, the world crashes, it's in bad shape. Things don't get much better, Cain kills Abel, you have the Dar of Enosh, which is the first generation of idol worship, God is not too happy with that, he floods one third of the world. Mankind doesn't really get the message, things continue to deteriorate. We have a flood. After the flood, mankind says, we don't want another flood. We'd better try to take control of the world on our own. We're going to kick God out. We will take control of the world. And they try to build a tower. This is not our class today, but we've discussed this in the past. It's on the Kolo archives. When we have the app, it'll be on there also. And the idea of that tower was not just, let's see who can build the highest tower. But the idea of the tower was a tower to utilize the various forces in creation that God had put in there to allow them to wrest control, spiritual control of the entirety of creation. Hashem foils their plot, and we move on. At that point, God said, okay, is there anyone in this world who's interested in bringing the world back to its purpose? And there was one man. There was one man, and the Medrash tells us, vociferously protested the construction of this tower. And his name was? Anybody?
Abraham.
Avram, right? Avram was around at that time. Avram was around then. He was not 3 years old at that point. He was somewhat older. He had already gone through the experience with Nimrod, and he was very much a person who was running around and making an impact. But the powers that be said, nah, he's not having any kids. Don't worry about him. He'll die. He'll move on. We'll continue on our merry way. But Avram was there. Avram gave birth to a Yitzchak. Yitzchak gave birth to a Yaakov. And here we have the three patriarchs. And we have the four matriarchs. And this is where the Jewish people are born. The Jewish people are going to bring the world back to where it needs to get to. They're going to bring it back to God. There are 10 layers of hiddenness. And the purpose of the world is to reveal God's presence through those 10 layers. During the course of all these years, those 10 layers, instead of being peeled away, have grown thicker and thicker and thicker. Okay, our sages tell us that with every succeeding generation, every succeeding debacle that took place during the course of the years, God moved further and further away from the world. Okay, there are 7 heavens. This is not just an idea that when you go to, Baskin Robbins and you have some good ice cream, you're in 7th heaven. Hopefully 7th heaven is something more than that. But it's the idea of 7 heavens are 7 layers of spirituality. And the higher up one goes, the further removed one is from this world. Okay? And our sages, Chazal, tell us that with every succeeding generation, Hashem moved further and further away. With the appearance of Avram on the scene, Hashem started to descend, come back. The Shekhinah, the Divine Presence, began to reconnect, to come back into this world. And finally, that occurred with the giving of the Torah on Sinai. Things got messed up with the sin of the golden calf, but it culminated with this week's parasha, the construction of the tabernacle of the Mishkan. The Shekhinah resided in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle. More about that very soon. Okay, but that is the process. That is the process. First, you have all these generations. Hashem was further and further away, and then you have, beginning with Avram, through the Jewish people going through, and it comes back. Our sages tell us, Chazal tell us, that Avram recognized Hashem. The way it's expressed and the way it's said is that Abraham was like a person walking on the street and he sees a bira. A bira is like a palace or a mansion. Dolekes. There are many interpretations of what the word dolekes means. It may mean on fire. It may mean lit up. It may mean running. The word dolek means to chase or to be running or fleeing. Okay, but the point is that it was like a person walking down the block and he sees this great mansion, either it's lit up or it's on fire, and Abraham said, this thing didn't just come here, someone's responsible for this, someone's taking care of this. Okay? And Avram, through his own philosophical objective, philosophical journeys, came to the conclusion there must be a God. And he said there must be someone in charge of this, and then Hashem poked his head out, as it were. The Medrash says that the owner of the beer pokes his head out, the palace pokes his head out and says, hi, I'm the owner. I'm in charge. I'm responsible. I'm taking care of this. Okay? Now, that Medrash itself means a lot of discussion. Sorry, not for tonight. I have to keep you coming back. But what is relevant for our purposes is the basic metaphor of a beer of a palace is indicative of how Avram and the other patriarchs came to recognize Hashem. They looked at the world and they said, someone must be in charge of this world. Someone has to be in charge. This didn't come here on its own. It didn't just evolve on its own over the course of billions of years. Okay? Even with all the nice long scientific explanations you're going to give me, do you really believe that's how it got here? Ultimately, objectively, it doesn't make sense. Objectively, it's very hard to swallow. There must be an owner to this palace. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov came to recognize Hashem through the natural world, through creation. Okay? And here's where life gets interesting. Because at the beginning of Parshas Va'era, okay, at the end of Parshas Shemos, Moshe comes back to God, and after having gone to Paro, and Paro snubs him, kicks him out of the palace, and says, Jewish people have way too much time on their hands. They're thinking about freedom. You're fomenting a revolt. No more straw. Everyone has to gather their own straw. Moshe goes back to Hashem. He says, God, this is not working out at all the way it was supposed to. Why did you send me? I told you this is a bad idea. And God basically rebukes him and says, you're questioning me. I know what's going on over here. End of Parsha. Next Parsha begins. Parsha is Va'era. And Hashem says, I appeared to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov with the name Kel Shakai. Okay? A name of Hashem, Kel Shakai, spelled the Shin Dalad Yud. Okay, and that name of Hashem, Rashi tells us, comes from the Hebrew word dai. She dai. That it is enough. That is enough. Okay, that itself is a lengthy discussion, but again, for our purposes, everything is a lengthy discussion, I'm sorry. But for our purposes, that means that when Hashem created the world, he said, enough. And what does that mean? So Rashi explains, when Hashem created the world, the world began to expand and began to spread more and more. And Hashem said, enough! And the world stopped expanding. The world stopped expanding. Okay? What does that mean? That the world began to spread and then Hashem said, enough, and it stopped expanding. Whenever I say this, I'm going to go off topic here for a moment. Should I even bring this up? Okay. One of the Star Trek movies, there's something called The Genesis. Anyone familiar?
Yeah.
Okay, if no one's familiar, I'm going to stop right now because it's not worth me to make a fool of myself for this. But anyways, they have this missile, you shoot at a planet, and the whole planet goes through creation. And someone messed around with it that it should fast forward too fast, and the whole thing goes haywire. Okay, but you see like this thing like, boom, this explosion, and the whole planet just bursts into bloom, and everything's wonderful for a while. Okay, so whenever I say, enough, I just see in my mind like this whole planet exploding, and then it stops. Freeze frame. In a sense, what happened was Hashem creates the world. But remember, the world hides Hashem. So the more the world expands. We're not talking about expanding in terms necessarily of space. Expanding in terms of helim, hiddenness. How much is this world going to hide Hashem's presence? And Hashem says, that's enough. Right now there's a perfect balance in this world between hiding Hashem and allowing you to perceive Him through the creation that He put into place. There's a perfect balance. We're here to work on ourselves. If it's too obvious, you don't speed when the cop is sitting right there. Anyone ever go down Spirit Boulevard? You see that? You see that truck over there? Right? Unless you really don't care, you slow down, right? If you're not sure if it's there, so you speed and you keep an eye out. You know? 50% of the time it's there, you're not going to see it. But I'll take my chance because, you know, it might not be there. When it's there, you don't speed. Right? Someone told me a story of a woman in Flatbush, a very wealthy woman from a certain very wealthy community in Flatbush. Those who ever try to park in Flatbush know that it's impossible. Mm-hmm. She parked her car, I think, in front of a hydrant or a bus stop, and as she was walking up the block, she bumped into a meter maid. Those who know what meter maids are, they are the, usually women, sometimes men, who go up and down the blocks putting tickets in all the cars for the expired meters and the, what? Well, okay, well, I think that you'll forgive me, that term is used a little too liberally sometimes, but I've heard the term also. But anyways, so I was told that this very well-to-do woman from a very well-to-do, I don't care type of background, told the meter maid, just put it in the windshield as she walked by. She wanted the parking spot. But generally, when the cop is sitting right there, you don't speed, right? And if there are never any police, you never saw any police in this stretch of road at all, everyone's going to speed. The perfect balance is sometimes the police is there, sometimes it's not, so you may or may not speed depending on your mood. That's this world. This world is the perfect balance. Shaddai, that is the name. There's enough. In other words, that name of Hashem is the name of Hashem that we relate to as we can perceive Hashem to a certain degree if we try hard. We can ignore it. We can see it. But there's a balance of perceiving Hashem or not perceiving Hashem in creation. And all names of Hashem, all the names, different names you find in the Torah, Elohim and Kael, and all those names are names of how we relate to Hashem through creation. Different names indicate different things. Elohim is Hashem's judgment. This name, Shakai Shaddai, is Hashem relating to us as a balance of revelation and not revelation, and so on and so forth. Okay? Hashem tells Moshe, I appeared to the patriarchs with this name of Shakai, Ushmi Hashem, but my name Hashem, Yud Hei Vav Hei, okay, the four-letter name of Hashem that we do not pronounce as it's written. Okay, we say Ado instead of saying the Yud Kei Vav Kei. That name of Hashem, the four-letter name, I did not lo nodati lohem. I did not make known to them. I didn't make it known to them. So Rashi says, what does it mean? I did not make it known to them. If you look in the verses, sometimes Hashem appears to Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov with that name. So what does it mean? So there's a lot of different explanations. But the Ibn Ezra, quoted by the Ramban, Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra, a great Spanish commentator, he says that it means as follows. He says what it means is that the patriarchs perceived Hashem through the natural world. Their relationship to Hashem was through the natural world. Their work was to connect to Hashem through the natural world. And hence the Torah speaks at great length about all the happenings of the patriarchs in their regular lives. A lot more stories going on with the patriarchs and the matriarchs than you'll find with their descendants later, where you have entire tractates of Talmud from a couple words. I think you have three tractates of Talmud from one verse. Okay? And so there's it's why? Why? Because the patriarchs connected to Hashem through the natural world, through nature. That was their work. That's what they did. And Ibn Ezra goes so far as to say that God did not tear down the natural order of things in order to help them. God helped them within nature. Now that's again a lengthier discussion. We do know there were certain miracles that took place. Hashem saved Abraham from the fire by Nimrod. We know the story that when Avram went to war against the four kings. He threw sand, it turned into arrows. There were other miracles which took place. Okay? But these miracles were miracles which were within the confines of the natural world. What does that mean? A lengthier discussion? Very briefly, I'll just try to give one example. Fire burns. Fire burns in this world that is part of how it manifests itself in this physical world. Okay, the nature of fire is not necessarily that it has to burn. It just within the normal guidelines of the physical world, to a normal human being, it burns that person. Okay? A person who is worthy, person who is above sin, who is removed from the regular physical approach of this world, lives within this world, but is not pulled down by it. Fire does not necessarily affect that person the same way. Why a lengthier discussion? But suffice it to say, there were great people. The person who I'm saying this thought over from, Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, the Beis Halevi, lived in 19th century Russia, is said to have tested himself occasionally to see where he was holding as an individual by putting fire to his hand and seeing if it burned him. Okay, he stopped because someone saw him doing it. Okay, the Talmud says that one of the sages would go into a lit oven regularly to see if he would get harmed at all, to make sure he was still pure and free of sin. Okay, the Talmud says that one time some of the other sages noticed it, and they kind of half thought to themselves, look at him. And that kind of created an evil eye, and his feet got singed. And thereafter he was called Rev Shashis of the singed feet. But, okay, that's a difference. I think so. Okay, so fire doesn't have to burn within the natural confines of the world. And hence, who saves Avram from the fire? The Medrash says that Gabriel, the angel Gabriel, came down and saved Avram, because Gabriel is the angel who is in charge of fire. In other words, angels are part of the natural world. They're part of the world Hashem created. And so, when the natural order of fire is not to burn, the angel in charge of that fire gets involved. You don't need God himself to come in and save Abraham. The angel will come and save him, because it's still parcel of the natural system. Okay? Contrast that, and I don't want to give away too much for next week, but contrast that to what took place at the splitting of the sea, if you will, where God told the angel of the sea, split. And the angel of the sea said, no. Said, no. You created me to flow. Water doesn't split. And God said, well, I have to save the Jewish people. And the angel said, well, they don't deserve it. Okay? But there was this back and forth with the Jewish people. The angel said, based on the way I'm creating the natural order of things, Jewish people don't deserve to be saved. More about that next week. But what I'm driving at over here is that the patriarchs related to Hashem through the natural order of things, through the natural world. When it came time for the Jewish people to leave Egypt, it wasn't just they were going to go out of Egypt and everything was going to be great, and they would go into the desert and go to the land of Israel, and they would go back to where their forefathers had lived and had stood and had accomplished. That was part of it, but it was more than that. There had to be a cataclysmic shift, a gigantic switch in world order that was going to take place when the Jewish people are leaving Egypt. This is the birth of the Jewish nation. Okay? Patriarchs achieved a lot, but Ramchal, Rabbi Lutzaro tells us, they didn't achieve nationhood. They created the roots, the foundations. But where would those roots and foundations sprout into a full tree with branches and so on and so forth? In Egypt, and the Jewish people would come out and create the nation of the Jewish people. And that's where a gigantic shift is going to take place. Because until now, yes, the patriarchs achieved much, and they brought Hashem back into creation. But they're still relating to Hashem. The way Hashem runs the world is through the natural world. You can see Hashem, you can connect to Hashem through the natural world, but it's still, when all is said and done, it's still the natural world. When are we going to reach a point where Hashem reveals himself and runs the world in a way, in a fashion, that is apart from the natural world? Avram sees Hashem through the palace, through the mansion. Avram senses Hashem through the natural world. The Jewish people are not going to relate to Hashem that way. The Jewish people are going to stand at Sinai, and God is going to rip open all seven heavens and all seven levels of depths of Gehenna, if you will, or what's called Tahom, of hiddenness of Hashem. Everything will be torn open. They're going to see everything is Hashem. When God gave the Torah at Sinai, all of nature stopped, stood stock still, because the giving of the Torah at Sinai is the revelation that God is one beyond the natural world. That God runs this world and he's not beholden to the natural world. Okay, the name of that four-letter name of Hashem, Hayahavaviyah, that four-letter name will be. Hayahavaviyah, right? Havaya, those four letters. Yud-Kevav-Kev, that four-letter name is, and will be. In other words, unchanging. He is what he is. It doesn't matter what goes on in this world. Nothing matters at all. He is. And he always will be, he always was, he is, and he always will be. It's unchanging, nothing changes. Yaakov, when he comes back from the house of Laban, And he hears Esav is on his way to attack him. He says, Hashem, he's terrified. Esav is going to attack me. Asks Rashi, didn't Hashem promise you that he's going to take care of you? So Rashi says, Chazal tell us, he was scared lest he sinned. What do you mean, Hashem promised you? Didn't Hashem promise you? It was fine, you sinned, but Hashem promised you. The answer is, Yaakov relates to Hashem through the natural world. Natural means things can change. Natural means I need to deserve it to get it. Yes, there's a promise coming from Hashem. But I don't relate to Hashem my relationship, I may recognize that Hashem exists as unchanging, but my relationship with Him is through the natural world, and natural world, there's an order. You have to deserve things to get it. There may be a promise, but who says that promise is coming to me if I'm not worthy of getting that promise? Whereas the Jewish people in Egypt, were they worthy, really, to be redeemed from Egypt? Not at all. What happens? The Torah says, Hashem remembered His promise to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Okay, but we know that the Jewish people were not worthy. They had to get two special commandments just to pull themselves out of Egypt. Right? The Pesach offering and circumcision. A discussion unto itself yet again. Suffice it to say that those two mitzvahs have to do with blood. Blood is circulation. Circulation is, let's get things moving, right? So, life. For the Jewish people to exist, for the circulatory system to exist, for them to connect to Hashem and to be able to live life, they need these blood mitzvahs to get the mitzvah through the blood, to get things moving, to get the circulation system going. But did they have the merits to get out? No. Did they have the merits of the seed to split? No. Rashi makes very clear that they really didn't. Okay? They didn't have those merits. So how did they get saved? Hashem promised. Didn't help Yaakov. Why does it help them? If it didn't help Yaakov, why does it help them? Because here's the difference. Yaakov lives in a world of, I relate to Hashem through the natural world. Natural world, maybe I deserve it, maybe I don't. The Jewish people are shifting. Now there's going to be a shift from relating to Hashem in natural world to relating to Hashem beyond the natural world. Beyond the natural world. It's not beholden to the natural world. And so that's the shift. And that's what Hashem tells Moshe. I appear to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And Moshe comes to Hashem and says, what's going on here? They're not getting out of Egypt. This is not happening. It's locked up and Egypt is not letting them go and they don't deserve it. And Hashem says, relax. Relax. Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov didn't have a problem with it, and they didn't even experience this level. And here I'm telling you, I'm moving into this mode. I appeared to them with the name of Shakai, natural world, but I didn't tell them my name Havaya. Now I'm moving into that name, that world, that mode of Havaya, of beyond the natural world, and the Jewish people will get out because of that. Okay? That's the shift that's taking place. What does this have to do with 10 plagues? I'm sure you're wondering. So let's go back. Before I go on, any questions before I move on? We'll make a stop over here. Yeah.
Is that still how, jumping in here, but is that still how Hashem relates to us?
Yes, okay. Potentially. I mean, we have that potential to relate to Hashem that way. We don't always relate to Hashem that way, but we have that ability to relate to Hashem that way. Okay? I'll just drop one hint over here. The 13 attributes of mercy, the Yud Gil Midas HaRachamim. What does Hashem tell Moshe? When all hope is lost, say this. Okay, that Shem Havaya, that four-letter name, is Hashem's Midah of Rachamim. Rachamim is beyond natural. When all hope seems lost, when it's all over, meaning you look at the world and say, nowhere to go, it's not happening. There's another mode outside of that. Right? I have to get out of that box. Okay? What does that have to do with Egypt? Let's talk about Egypt versus the land of Israel for a moment, if we can. The Torah tells us, in Parshas Ekev, that Moshe tells the Jewish people, this land that you're coming to, the land of Israel, it's not like Egypt. In Egypt, you know how they water their crops in Egypt? They have a Nile River, okay, and the Nile floods, and you gotta schlep and dig irrigation ditches and schlep the buckets and so on and so forth, and that's how they water their crops. In Israel, in the land of Israel, in Eretz Israel, the Torah makes very clear, it is dependent upon rain from Hashem. Okay, yes, today they have all sorts of technology, they made it into Mitzrayim, thank God. Okay, Baruch Hashem, I'm not criticizing it, I'm just making a point that the ideal land, I'm not saying you should just sit and wait for the rain to fall. If you have technology, use it. But ideally, the land of Israel, when everything is spiritually perfect, is that you look to Shemaim, you look to heaven, and Hashem and says, Hashem, I need rain. And it rains. Right? That is the land of Israel. And Egypt is exactly the opposite. Egypt, it never rains in Egypt. They get all their water from the Nile. In other words, Egypt never has to look heavenward. Egypt has everything it needs right there in their little bubble, okay, with the Nile, and they get everything they need from themselves. They are self-sufficient. They don't need to connect to heaven in the slightest. In other words, the Egyptian culture, the Egyptian mindset is God. Para says, I am God. Okay? The verse in Ezekiel, Para says, there are two different verses. One is, the Nile, the river is mine, and I created it. And in a second verse, he says, the river is mine, and I created me. I created myself. Never heard the expression self-made man? Huh? Okay. Is there anything haughtier than saying I'm a self-made man? Isn't that what people think themselves? I picked myself up by my own bootstraps and I made myself what I am today. Uh-huh. And where was God in all this? Well, he was nice enough to stay out. Okay. So Egypt is the place of absolute focus on the natural and complete disconnect from heaven, from Hashem. That is Egypt. And when the Jewish people went down for the Egyptian exile, what happened to them? They were swallowed, they were assimilated into Egypt. Right? Chazal, our sages, tell us that the Jewish people in Egypt were like a fetus inside the womb of the mother. And God, as it were, is like the shepherd who has to stick his hands inside and schlep the baby out, to get the baby out from inside. Because the mother, the child is connected and completely reliant upon the mother. And then the baby has to get schlepped out and pulled out. The Jewish people weren't just enslaved in Egypt. They weren't just exiled in Egypt. They weren't just tortured in Egypt. They were ensconced. They were completely connected to Egypt. Their entire life's blood, literally, came from Egypt. And hence, going back to what I mentioned earlier, the two mitzvahs to get out were Pesach and Milo, right? The Pesach offering and circumcision, both a big focus on blood. Because what has to happen is the Jewish people have to cut themselves off from being attached to Egypt. Where are they attached to? They're attached to God. They're going to, right? Hashem says, I took you out from being slaves to Egypt, now you are my servants. Instead of being attached to Egypt, they're attached to Hashem. How are we going to create a new circulatory system of attachment to Hashem? We're going to make two mitzvahs that focus on blood. And through that blood, we create a blood connection, as it were, between us and Hashem. Okay? That's what's happening over here. But the Jewish people are completely swallowed up in the natural process of things. In other words, let's just take a step back and look at this. What happened? The patriarchs spent their lives, the patriarchs and matriarchs devoted their lives to recognizing and connecting and developing a relationship with Hashem through the natural world. Down they went into Egypt, 70 individuals, they became a great nation, and they became completely lost in that natural world. So much so that Maimonides, the Rambam, when he talks about it, he says it was just about lost, that spark, that connection, that Avram, that Abraham had, that the patriarchs had created, was virtually lost, just about. The Jewish people got out of Egypt in the nick of time before they completely lost everything. Okay? Before they were completely lost and disconnected from the patriarchs and the matriarchs, Hashem pulled them out from that mother, from that embryonic stage, and saved them in that last moment. But everything was lost because they became completely lost in the natural process. Okay? Yes.
Shevet Levi too?
No. But the Jewish people as a whole. You want to know, I have this question for a long time, I have not had an answer. Whenever the Jewish people get into trouble, the women and Shevet Levi always seem to rise above it. So why do they always get punished? I don't know. It's a good question.
The women got punished?
Huh? The women were enslaved as well. But I mean, in Egypt, the women were assimilated as well. They were not attacked by the Egyptians in terms of the purity that was maintained. That's very clear. There was one exception with one woman, but otherwise, both the men and the women kept apart from the Egyptians in terms of family life. But in terms of assimilation and idolatry and Egyptian culture, by and large, they were assimilated, the women as well. Okay, other places, they weren't part of the golden calf. That's why I get to do the laundry on Rosh Chodesh. So, last time I did it, I mixed all the whites and colors together, and that was that. So,
Did the Jews know any of this was, like, was that, did the Jews have any idea that any of this was being planned?
Yes. Yes. They knew that they had scrolls with their history and with certain commandments that they had in traditions from
also,
generations back.
Yaakov's daughters was still alive.
Yes, Sarah was alive. They knew there was a tradition passed down from one generation to the next that a redeemer would appear.
But they didn't believe that God was really going to.
They did. Moshe initially tells God they're not going to believe me. God says, try it. Let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Moshe was taken to task for questioning their belief because they did believe initially.
Why did it have to take so long?
Really should have taken longer.
Yeah.
That's a longer discussion of the whole purpose of the exile in the first place. That's
but if it had not taken so long, then maybe people would not have been so, you know, not believing.
Assimilated.
Especially the men.
Yeah, you're right. The reason they left early was because it got to the point of no return, and if they wouldn't have gone out, then it would have been totally lost. Really, they should have stayed longer. They had more work to do. That work is, I don't mean work in terms of slave labor, work, spiritual work. That's a longer discussion. I don't have time now for that. But there was a purpose. They left early. Let's just put it that way. They left early. The 400 years were counted from a different point in time. So they left work unfinished. Okay, that's why. By the way, one of the reasons this is very tangential, but it's your fault. So we eat. A lot of people have a custom. We have a custom to eat an egg at the Seder. One of the reasons we have is because a sign of mourning for the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. Okay, the first night of Pesach is always the same night as Tisha B'Av. And so we eat an egg to commemorate that the first night of Pesach is Tisha B'Av. This is not coincidental. Okay, the Jewish people left Egypt and it's a night of celebration. But there's an element of disappointment, of mourning. Because they left early, they left unfinished work. They weren't able to finish the process, leaving the potential for future exiles open. Okay, and so the night of Pesach is within it contains the seeds of Tisha B'Av of the destruction of the temple, because they left unfinished business. Back to our discussion. So Maimonides tells us they were almost completely lost. What are they lost in? They're engulfed, they're swamped, they're swallowed up in a bubble of natural world, no connection to God, no connection to anything beyond it, no relationship whatsoever. And the Jewish people have to get out of this. Because God is waiting to turn this around and create a whole new world where He's going to run the world with a revelation of, it's not just about the natural world. And God doesn't just connect you through the natural world, He connects you through a higher mode of interaction. Okay? Where does that higher mode of interaction really begin and really come to bear? As I mentioned, at Sinai. At Sinai is where the Torah is given. The Torah is created before the world is created. Right? Our sages tell us the Torah precedes the world. In other words, I have the natural world, then I have Torah. Torah is beyond this world. Okay? Connecting to Hashem through Torah is connecting beyond this world. It's a higher level of existence that's not tied down to the natural world. And so we're going to have a shift. Now let's put everything together. Creation. Hashem creates the world with 10 statements, 10 utterances, 10 layers of hiding of Hashem. Okay? And people have to connect to Hashem through those 10 layers. But it's not happening. Okay? The patriarchs succeed to a degree. They create something real. The Jews go down to Egypt, it's falling apart. And now it's going to shift from 10 layers, 10 utterances, that's the world we live, to a new world where Hashem conducts the world through, beyond the natural world, through Torah. How does He give the Torah? Through 10 utterances, also known as Aseret HaDibros. Aseret HaDibros. But it's a transition, because I'm moving from 10 utterances that create a natural world to 10 utterances that create a supernatural world. It's a different world. It's a whole different existence. This is an existence where, yeah, there's a natural world, but there's something much bigger that you can connect through Torah. And those 10 utterances are 10 levels. It's the same world, but it's a whole different world. It's the same world, but now within those 10 layers, you have Torah. And Torah allows you to connect through this world to a higher reality. Beyond this world. Okay, that's what the Torah is going to allow mankind, specifically the Jewish people, to do, is to connect through this world to a higher reality. Those 10 utterances. I just saw today someone quotes the Chiddush Arim. The Chiddush Arim was the first Rebbe of the Gerach Hasidus, and he says the following words, and I'll expand on what he said. He said that the means of transitioning from the Asar Mamoros, from the 10 utterances, to the Aseres Hadibros, to the 10 commandments, is through the 10 plagues. Say it again. The means of switching from here to here, from these 10 to these 10, is through the 10 plagues. Okay? I'm sure a lot of you have heard the idea I mentioned at the outset that the 10 plagues parallel the 10 utterances of creation. And while there is a very great deal of discussion exactly how they parallel, and it's not easy to get through all 10, I myself have not been through all 10, we can there are differing opinions as to whether they parallel from the top down or inversely, meaning the 10 utterances start from Bereshis and work their way forward. Do the 10 plagues also work? Do they parallel one by one from the beginning to the end? Does blood parallel in the beginning? Does frogs parallel let there be light? Or is it the other way around? That you have to start from the top down, right? If you have 10 layers, you have 10 layers of appeal. You peel away the outer layer first, okay? So if you're breaking down the veils, the hiddenness of creation, you start from the last one and work your way forward towards the front. Okay, so the easiest three to talk about are the last three plagues. Makas Bechoros, the plague of the firstborn, parallels Bereshis in the beginning. The firstborn, you see the connection. Bereshis in the beginning, plague of the firstborn. Exactly what the connection is, broader discussion, but Choshech, darkness, parallels, let there be light. Arber, locus, Rabbi, what does locus have to do with the third, which is let there be a firmament. Yehirakia, let there be a firmament, or whatever you want to call it, Rikia, is the separation between the physical and the spiritual. What does the Torah say about Arba? It says that they blocked out the sky and they covered the earth. In other words, these grasshoppers didn't just eat everything on the earth, they created a barrier. Kisas in Aretz, they covered the eye of the earth. They completely covered everything. Huh? They made, exactly. They blocked out. They blocked out. They created a partition between heaven and earth. Okay, so you have, now why? Because here's Paro, here's the Egyptians. And the Egyptians said, we have our nice little world over here. We have our Nile. God could go do his own thing. We're doing just fine over here. We have our Nile. We don't need rain from heaven. Everything's just hunky-dory right here. Okay, and what does Paro say when he talks to Yosef? When he makes Yosef king, he says, Ani Paro. I am Paro. Okay, and what does Hashem say, Ani Hashem. I am Hashem. The Ani, what's the Ani? The Ani is the I. Me, I. The existence. Paro says, I am the existence. It's about me. Yeah, you're viceroy, you have a lot of power, but you know where it all starts and ends? Ani Paro. I am Paro. Okay? That's Paro's attitude. And when Moshe comes and says, God says you gotta let the Jewish people go, Paro says, who? Never heard of him. Hashem? Never heard of him. Paro had lots of his own gods. It wasn't like he didn't believe in deities. But the idea that there's something beyond the natural. All the Egyptian gods are forces of the natural world. You have the sun god and the moon god and the sheep and the snake and the alligator. One of my kids just got one of these Discover books all about Egypt. So I got to learn all about the different Egyptian gods. They have like 37 of them or something. I don't know. They have a crocodile and the hippo and the snake and the dog and the jackal and the cat and the... It's a whole zoo. So okay, but everything is natural. It's all natural, organic.
Is it a book of Bodhisattva about animals?
No, it's a book all about it. It's in my house, right? Well, I have to give this class. The Gemara says you're allowed to learn about Bodhisattva for the purpose of knowing what you're dealing with. I wouldn't be able to have given that wonderful class, My kids are bookworms, so they all read. Most of the time, except when it's time to do homework. But anyways, so that's a natural one. Hashem comes and says, this world of Asar Mamoros, it's breaking down. Egypt, you have this natural world, it's going to fall apart. And every layer of these 10 plagues that falls apart, okay, is going to another layer of releasing the Jewish people from the prison in which they are imprisoned. Because what are they imprisoned in? They're imprisoned in Egypt. Egypt is all about natural world. The Jewish people are swallowed up. They're inside the belly of this terrible beast called Egypt, called everything is about me and about where I am and this natural world. And every layer that breaks down is a destruction of one layer of the natural, disconnected from God world. B, it's another layer less that's imprisoning the Jewish people. C, it's another layer of breaking down the Asar Mamaros. And D, it's another layer of allowing a new reality to be created. Okay? So when Hashem says to Avram, and the nation, that they will serve, I will judge, it's not about punishment per se. It's about the need of Egypt to break down and fall apart as part of this transitioning process. Hashem is telling Avram, your children are not just going to go down into Egypt for the fun of it to be enslaved. This is part of a process of transition. They have to go into exile in order to allow a whole new world order to emerge. It's not going to emerge otherwise. Now, why the exile? That's a separate discussion. It was a purification process for the Jewish people to be able to move into that world. But ultimately, Hashem says they'll go through this experience and then I will judge the nation that enslaved them. In other words, I will pick them apart, not for the sake of punishment in of itself, per se, but measure for measure, everything the Egyptians do to the Jewish people, to enslave them, to lock them in this dungeon of disconnectedness, to lock them in this prison, to make them stuck inside the great belly of Egypt and say, this is where it starts, this is where it ends. No one gets out of Egypt. No slave ever escaped Egypt. Okay, the anomaly of the Exodus was that no slaves escaped Egypt. You know why? Because what? Besides the desert. Even if you manage to find a Coca-Cola machine and a McDonald's somewhere along the way, but in spiritual terms, you're right. But in spiritual terms, no one escaped Egypt because this is where it starts and this is where it ends. It's all here. There's nowhere else to go. It's all here. We're all concentrated over here. We're the ones running the show. We're the ones who make the rules. It's all about us. And they had that spiritual power. They had the physical power as well. It manifested itself in the physical world as being the most powerful civilization on the planet at that time. But it was about the spiritual power of it's all here, it all starts and ends here. And Hashem is going to pull that apart layer by layer. He's going to peel it away. Excuse me. Layer by layer until the old world of the natural world is dead, is gone. And now the Jewish people can move towards Sinai and create a new world order. And that world order is the ten commandments, the Aseret HaDibros. Till now it was a world of natural. Now it's going to be a world of Torah, a world of where Hashem can be manifest, where you can connect to Hashem beyond the confines of the natural world. And that's the process. That's the process. And so the 10 plagues are everything we talked about, and yet they all unify. Because we started off saying, is it a punishment? Is it a means of freeing the Jewish people? Is it a means of showing that Hashem is in charge? Which one? The different verses seem to indicate all the above. The answer is, you're right, it is all the above. But it all boils down to one point. That one point is that the 10 plagues are the means of moving from the 10 utterances to the 10 commandments. And everything orbits around that. Everything is focused around that point. It's the destruction of the old world order. That's what we're calling the punishment of the Egyptians. Measure for measure. Hashem is doing battle with Egypt as a world war. He's destroying the old natural world order. The Jewish people will be freed. They're the ones who are going to be the leaders in this new approach of the world. Okay? And so it's a building of a new world. And that's why Hashem keeps saying, so that Paro knows that I am Hashem. Because Pyro needs to know that also. What's the ultimate purpose of the world? To recognize Hashem in the world. Pyro needs to know that also. Okay, and the commentators point out, splitting of the sea. Hashem said, I'm going to split the sea, I'm going to punish the Egyptians, so that they will know I am Hashem. How long did they know for? They all died. How long did they know for? It doesn't matter. That's the purpose of the world. So Hashem says, I'm going to reach that purpose. It's going to cost them their lives. But that's what the purpose of the world is. So at least for a moment, there will be a display before they perish. I am Hashem. I'm the one in charge. It's not about nature. It's about me, says Hashem. Okay? That's the whole process over here. I want to share with you one, I have a few minutes left. I want to share with you a fascinating thought. Fascinating thought. Did you ever notice that the plagues are split into two batches? You have one parasha, parashas of Eir, you have seven plagues. Okay, then the parasha ends with the plague of hail. That ends with that plague. And then the next parasha, parashas Bo, Hashem told Moshe, Bo el Paro, come to Paro, because I have hardened his heart. I have hardened the heart and the heart of his servants, so that I may place my wonders among him, In order that, so that I may place my wonders among him. Okay? So there's a break over here. Hashem keeps telling Moshe, go to Paro and tell him this plague is coming, and that plague is coming, and that plague is coming. Parsha ends after seven plagues. Then I have a new Parsha, Parsha's Bo, and Hashem tells Moshe, come to Paro again, so that I may place my wonders against him. Why now? Why is Hashem making this statement now? What happened to the last seven plagues? Okay, Hashem gives that whole speech kind of at the beginning of the process. But you don't see it by every plague. You see it before the plague of locusts. Plague number 8. Okay, why? And by the way, I'm sure my kids always come home and they say, Parsha's Bo, the numerical value of Bo is 3, because there are 3 plagues in the Parsha of Bo, and that's why there are 3 plagues. Very nice. I don't know if that's true or not. It just happenstance. But if someone has a source for it besides, the Morris papers, please let me know. Nothing against the Morris papers, God forbid. But I'm curious to know if there's a source for that. But in any event, why the split? Why the split? Well, let's think about it for a minute. There are 10 layers. Yes? Those 10 layers, we know there's something called Eser Sfiros, the 10 levels of interaction of Hashem with the world. Those 10 layers split into 2 groups, right? 7 and 3. 7 levels of the natural world. Everything in the natural world is 7. You have 7 days of the week, 7 colors in the rainbow, 7 musical notes, etc., etc. Then you have 3 more beyond that. 3 more beyond the natural world. 3 more that are on a higher level. Okay? In the summer, we talked about the 3 weeks of the Haftorahs before Tisha B'Av, of punishment, 3 weeks, and then the 7 afterwards. Okay? And we discussed the idea that the 3 are really good, but we perceive them as bad in this world. The first 3 are beyond this world. Okay, in other words, 7 always parallels the natural world. 3 is beyond, is a step above nature. Okay, is the number 3. Ultimately, all within the confines of Teva, of nature, but you have 7 and 3 within the human body. 7 are the guf from here, about here down, and then you have 3 that are above, what we might call seichel. The intellect contains within it the 3 higher levels, and the body contains 7 below. Okay, let's talk about body and mind for a moment because it's important and this will help us understand it and understand what Paro is going through over here. And I think it's a very, very fascinating insight. You have 2 types of people, well, a lot more than that, but 2 basic groups of people who do bad things. You have people who do bad things and know they're doing bad things but have a hard time getting past it because they have bad midos or so on and so forth. They're not convinced that what they're doing is right. But they do it anyways because I have a temper, because I'm greedy, because I'm hungry, because I'm selfish, whatever it is. Okay? That is the lower self. The lower self is I need to work on myself, I need to work on my midos, on my personality, on my character traits to refine myself. Then you have the person who has done that for so long and has become so used to it and so convinced that this is normal that they create an entire approach to rationalizing why that's okay. If you don't believe me, just go look at the state of the world today, right? Everything that is morally decrepit and wrong and backwards becomes the biggest mitzvah. And if you think otherwise, you're the crazy one, right? Okay? Heaven help you if you say a word against any of these things, because then you're nuts. You're xenophobic, you're dysphobic, and that phobic, whatever. I don't know. When I was a kid, the only thing you were phobic of was spiders and small spaces. But today, all right. So, okay, you create an entire movement out of it, because what happens? In an ideal situation, your intellect is supposed to influence your character. I know this. I know I'm supposed to become. Okay, mind over matter. Mind over matter. What happens to some people is the mind doesn't work over the matter, so it goes the other way. The matter, the lower self, influences the intellect, influences the mind. Okay, this is a much bigger discussion, but we could suffice it to say with what we say in Shema, you shall not go after your eyes and after your heart. And Rashi says, the eyes see and the heart desires and the hands, the body does. Okay? It's supposed to be the other way around. Your mind is supposed to dictate to your heart and not the other way around. The problem is that your heart's desire, quote unquote, tends to dictate to your mind what it should think. That's the problem. Paro is stuck in this morass of his little bubble of it's all about me, I'm the God, I'm the creator, and everything is here and I'm the one in charge. the first seven makos were to break down paros and midos, to break down the seven lower levels. Again, how everything lines up with the spheres and so on, we're not going to go into, but just the overarching idea. The first seven makos were to break down the seven lower parts of paros' persona, of his personality. Had paros' way of life, had his approach, not permeated him and Egypt as a whole to such an extent that it became their culture, that's what they were, that was their way of thinking, that was their intellect, that's the whole mindset, then seven plagues would have sufficed to break down Paro, to break down Egypt, and that's as far as their machinations and their influence went. The Jewish people could have left, the breaking down process would have been complete. But Paro went further than that. Paro's way of life, his approach, influenced even his intellect, even his mind. And so even as Paro was starting to come around and realize, this is not going anywhere, this is not a good idea, and so on, and he starts telling Moshe, okay, I'll let you go. But he can't shake himself loose. He can't get out of it. Why can't he get out of it? Because even as the body, even as the lower self is breaking down, even as he sees, you ever see people who live their whole lives in a very, you have some people who live their lives perhaps not in the ideal way, but they have ideals, they wish they could do better, and as they age and as they get older and their interest in the physical lures of this world start to fall apart, they're able to better themselves and do a better job, because their whole life they were working towards that, they never quite got there, but they're working on it, and they're kind of, so as the temptations of this world start to fade away, the person moves on in life, they're able to better themselves, they're able to do better. Then you have people who's just the opposite, right? As they get older, it just gets worse and worse and worse. Why? Because they spent their life living their life so badly that it just takes over everything. Okay? And so it just infects everything. So as they age, they just fall apart. And hence you have in the Talmud a discussion between people who live in accordance with Torah, as they age, they get better, and people who don't, who just ignore it and just focus on living it up every moment as much as they can. And then as they get older, it just gets worse and worse. They become more and more egocentric, more and more self-centered, more and more looking for new pleasures and new things that they can spend their time on. Because even as much as they realize that it's not here, they can't tear themselves away from it. That's what they've become. That's what they are. It carries on into death as well. The Gemara says a story about, I'm past my time, let me just try to finish up here. Just very, very, very quickly. The Gemara says a story about a whole discussion unto itself, but two girls who died and had a conversation in the cemetery. And one of them said, I'm going to fly around to see what's going on in the world. The other one said, I can't come. I was buried improperly. I can't leave my grave. I'm not going to get involved in the details of the story. But the other one said, do me a favor. When you go flying around, bring me back my combs and my mirrors for my hair. Ugh, yeah, no hair. So Rabbi Dessler says, what do you mean? She's buried. It's finished. There's no hair to comb. He says, what a person becomes in their lifetime, even if there's nothing left, but that's the focus. That's what the person becomes. And so Paro, beyond the seven lower levels of body, the lower part, it had infected the whole approach of Egypt. This wasn't just that, yeah, they had higher ideals, but they couldn't quite get there. That became the culture. That became the whole essence of Egypt. And so the last three plagues are to break down those higher levels. Okay? And hence you have three groups of plagues, Tzach, Hadash, B'Yachav. Right? You have Tzach, Dam, Tzardei, Kinim, blood, frogs, lice. Group number two, Arev Devashin is wild animals, pestilence, and boils. And the last group is hail, locust, darkness, and the plague of the firstborn. Okay, a lot of talk about these three groups, but for our purposes, these three groups reflect three levels of creation. The first three are from the lower parts of creation. Dam is the water itself. Okay, it doesn't affect the land, it's the water. Next level, the frogs, amphibious creatures, they come out of the water onto the land. Next, the earth itself turns into lice. That's all earth. Next, we're going to move up a level. Now we're going to move beyond the earth onto the life on earth. We're going to have wild animals marauding and going crazy and rampaging everywhere. Then you have the death of the animals. Then you have shechin, boils in the bodies of the people. This is all middle. Right? Those things that walk on the earth. And the last group are Baradar, Bechosh, Chumakas. Bechoras come from the sky. Hail, locusts, darkness, plague of the firstborn is God himself. This is a process of breaking down. We're going to start from the bottom up. So the three groups are the three major areas of creation. Okay? The last three plagues, the very last three, this is not part of the grouping per se, but the last three plagues in Parshas Bo are those three higher levels that are going to break down Paro, not in his lower self, but in his intellect. In his intellect. That's that group. And so Hashem tells Moshe, Bo El Paro, I want you to come, El can mean to, can mean into. I want you to get into Paro. These last three plagues are not just coming to the lower part of Paro, it's into Paro. Into his essence, into his mind, into his whole worldview is going to fall apart now. And that's a whole different. I have hardened his heart and the hearts of his servants. There's a focus over here that the hardening of the heart has gone a step further. Because now it's not just about the heart anymore. The heart has infected the mind. The heart has infected the worldview. And so those last three layers have to break down as well. Bottom line, these 10 plagues are a shift from an old world of where it's all about nature to a new world where it's about connecting to Hashem beyond nature. What does that mean for us on Pesach? What does it mean for us on Pesach besides a lot of cleaning of chametz and so on and so forth? Okay, what it means for us on Pesach is that Pesach is that time where we can try to work and try to make that shift from I'm stuck, I'm mired in the natural world. If you notice, Purim comes before Pesach, and the Gemara says on purpose. We always make Purim. There are two Adars in the second Adar because we want to go straight from Purim to Pesach. Because Purim is the miraculous within nature. That's a discussion of itself. It's the melting away of nature. And Pesach is the revealed breaking down of nature. Okay? It's going from here to here. Okay? So Pesach is about moving past the natural world. Okay? And we don't have chametz on Pesach. We only eat matzah because it's a time to be without the Yetzirah, without the evil inclination who is represented by leavening, by chametz. It's a time where we can rise above the natural world that holds us down. To what degree everyone has their own things that I can't move past this. I'm stuck. I'm imprisoned. And Hashem comes and says, you're right. But there's a new world here. This new world says that even if you think there's no way out, naturally you can't move past this. But make the effort. And you'll see that you can make strides. Okay? And so that is what the period of Pesach is about. That, of course, takes us to the next step, which you'll have to come next week for the splitting of the sea. And hopefully we'll talk about also the period of Sfiras HaOmer as well, together with that, because as you're seeing over here from my discussion, this is one huge picture, starting from the Exodus through the giving of the Torah. So we'll try to focus on that next week. Okay? Thank you very much for coming. Thank you again, Mrs. Summers, for hosting. Next week, same time, same place, God willing. Yeah, go ahead.
Are you saying like the natural world, does that represent the mundane and Gashmian part of our lives versus the spiritual part?
Not necessarily.
Not
necessarily, because ultimately you have to live within a physical world.
Right.
But it's looking at the physical as just nothing more than physical. This is where it starts, this is where it ends. So it's getting stuck in Gashmis as an ends unto itself. Okay? You have three levels. You have natural, natural, natural. I'm just stuck. This is how it is. That's going to be. You have the Avos live in the world where they live in the natural world, but they, through the natural world, they connected. Okay? And then you have this level. Yeah, okay. I think. And then you have a level where just leave everything natural behind and move a step beyond that where you can move beyond the natural confines of the world as well. Or have at least the potential to aspire to that. That makes sense? Okay. Yeah.
I was in St. Louis.
Yeah, okay, so it seems. So I'm not sure. Thank you very much for coming. I'm not sure. I had the same question. The Ramchal, when he talks about the Avos and the need for going through the exile, in Derech Hashem, he seems to say that there was work left undone. I mean, Chazal talk about why, what did Avram do wrong that warranted an exile? So there were shortcomings, even at their level. Whether those shortcomings resulted in stopping at that level, not beyond it, I'm not sure. Or if that was just because it wasn't an entire nation yet. Ramchal says that the others were just the roots and the foundations, and then the Jewish people would emerge from that. Had they not had shortcomings, could the Jewish people have emerged from that without the process of exile? I would imagine, but I think even then it couldn't happen without the Jews as a nation. Ramchal makes clear they had to come as a nation, not just as a group of individuals. So the nationhood, that happened in Mitzrayim.
And had to sleep in Marsha.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.